Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Welcome back to Contemporary Issues, everybody. It's been like all summer since I saw you. Which, okay, is literally true in some of your cases, but...
You know who you are.
That's right. Well, this is the first of a, hopefully, 8, because that's how much content there is, week series on the book Always With Us, What Jesus Really Said About the Poor. And we will be digging into that here. But I'd like to open each class session with a prayer here, if I can.
Feel free.
So let us pray. Jesus, our Sovereign, you assure us that you are always with us to the end of the age. You tell us that whatever we do to the least of your kin, we do it to you. Teach us to see you and serve you in the poor. Help us to know you and believe in you through transforming relationships with those in need. We pray for the sake of your love. Amen. Now, I'm also doing something new. I'm going to be recording Contemporary Issues and posting that on the podcast along with the sermons. It won't be woven in with the sermon. That would be really confusing. So just FYI, there is a live microphone in the room that you're not in the habit of saying things that are terribly embarrassing, so that's really just a courtesy FYI, not a please watch yourselves.
Whether
he's
referring
to
you or not.
I have no idea who's directing that to.
So I'd like to introduce this book today. This book, Always With Us, What Jesus Really Said About the Poor. This was recommended by our General Assembly co-moderators, they were outgoing, now they're outgone, right? Former General Assembly co-moderators. They recommended it as a study for the entire Presbyterian Church. They say, one church, one book. Let's study something together. So that's what we're going to do. So we are going to study this this fall over the course of today and, if you count today, 8 weeks. Here's what the former co-moderators write about this book. We commend to your reading the Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris' book, Always With Us, What Jesus Really Said About the Poor. This book seeks to challenge our understandings of poverty and provide a theological undergirding for anti-poverty work. We believe Dr. Theo Harris's work will be transformational for congregations, both those who want to deepen their anti-poverty efforts or who already have robust ministries. We also strongly encourage Presbyterians to get and stay engaged with the New Poor People's Campaign, as there will be many opportunities therein to take risks for and with the poor. I'll put the website for that up in just a moment. Community, connection, and solidarity are characteristics of vital ministry. We are grateful for the many ways in which Presbyterians serve to grow God's reign, and we pray this new resource will help that work continue. So, this book is presented as a call to faithful action to help us understand what poverty is, where poverty comes from, and what God's intention is around poverty. And so, I want to help you engage with that through this study. So, what I'm going to do for each chapter in this book, I'm going to read a short passage from that chapter, then I'll outline the ideas that are covered there, and then we'll move to some reflection questions together. My intention is that you'll be able to engage in this whether or not you choose to read the book. If you do choose to read the book, it looks like this. This is its title. This is its author. It is available on Amazon Prime and other fine retail establishments. So if you have trouble getting your hands on one, let me know, and I can help you poke around and see what we can locate. If ordering things online is not your bag, check with Barnes & Noble. They can probably just order it in for you, and you can have someone there take care of that. If you'd rather have it ordered and shipped here and then reimburse the church, we can do it that way as well. So if you need help getting the book, I will help you get the book. But I am sensitive to what you said last spring when I asked, hey, what should we study? And you said, don't make us read. So I read harder so you don't have to. Okay. Check, make sure I got that website right. PoorPeople'sCampaign.org is the website for the new Poor People's Campaign. Those of you who were around for the original Poor People's Campaign know that it did not have a website, but the new one does. So there you go. And if you don't know the reference, then I'm sure the new Poor People's Campaign would explain that to you. Okay, so here is a little bit of narrative from the introduction to this book. In the winter of 1995, I was working with a group of homeless families with the Kensington Welfare Rights Union, who broke the locks and moved into St. Edward's Catholic Church at 8th and York Streets in North Philadelphia. The church had been closed that year because its members were poor, and the expansive, beautiful old building was expensive to heat. We broke the locks, moved in, and posted passages from the Bible on the walls, including Matthew 25, Luke 4, and Acts 4. We hung posters asking, why do we worship a homeless man on Sunday and ignore one on Monday? When asked by 9 Catholic priests from the Archdiocese to leave, we refused, stating, we talked to God, and God doesn't want any more homeless families. All are welcome to stay in God's house. And when we were threatened with eviction, we urged supporters to come witness with us at the church, declaring, Jesus is being evicted from a church in North Philadelphia. By hanging a sign that read, why do we worship a homeless man on Sundays and ignore one on Mondays, homeless members of the Kensington Workers' Rights Union made a bold statement that Jesus was a poor and oppressed person. They asserted that Christianity had to go beyond pie in the sky when you die and be relevant to the material reality of poverty and want of so many of God's children. The identification with Jesus as poor went farther than simply the social and economic context of Galilee in Jesus' day. These homeless families demonstrated that Christianity, the Jesus movement, was a social, political, economic, and spiritual movement led by the poor to transform all of society. So this book sort of began in that way, with the occupation of St. Edward's Church in North Philadelphia in 1995, when poor families and their allies moved into a church building that was being closed by its denominational leaders. So the church was too big, it was too expensive to heat and maintain, and it was being closed, and it was padlocked, right? Families who were poor and homeless moved into the church. And they made a couple of claims about their work moving into the church. The first thing they said was that Jesus was homeless. They can cite that scripturally. Actually, Luke chapter 9, verse 58 says, Jesus is saying, birds have nests and foxes have holes in the ground, and the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. And so they said, Jesus sounds homeless, and you are going to evict homeless people from your church. What does that mean for you as the church? And she, Liz Theo Harris describes the community that formed there as she fleshes out this narrative. She talks about the way that the families who gathered together in this church building really created a community that reflected the reign of God. People caring for each other, supporting each other's needs, offering their resources, skills, and abilities to the work of being a community there in that place. They were doing the community work that churches so often say that they are about. They were doing the community work of the reign of God. Theo Harris then goes on to give us some statistics on poverty. These are specifically statistics about about the Kensington neighborhood of Philadelphia. She writes that between the 1960s and the 1990s, so the 30 years prior to this occupation of St. Edward's Church, the process of deindustrialization took 250,000 jobs out of Kensington, Philadelphia. So 250,000 jobs left as industrial work either relocated, the factories themselves either relocated, or became automated in a way that meant that they didn't need as many people to do the same or more work, right? And so this process led to the loss of 250,000 jobs from this part of Philadelphia. She brings these statistics farther up to date. From 2007 through the present, 4 out of 5 Americans have been in or at risk of joblessness. And 1 out of 2, half of Americans, lives at less than 200% of the poverty line. And you know what the poverty line is? Very low. So relative to this particular poverty line number, which it would be hard for most people to live even themselves at the poverty line. But 1 out of 2 Americans lives at less than 200% of that. So there's not a lot of cushion there. And poverty, of course, has a disproportionate impact on minorities and women. So minorities and women are much more likely to be living in poverty than men or Caucasian people. And then we sort of get to the particular issue that Liz Theo Harris is attending to, and that is a theological problem as she sees it. She says that we often sort of throw up our hands at the idea of poverty. We neglect that poor people have the will and the capacity to challenge poverty, and when we do that, we fail to read the Bible correctly. The title of the book that we will spend a little bit more time with next week, but the title comes from a scene in Jesus' ministry in Matthew chapter 26, which is the very beginning of the passion narrative. And a woman comes and anoints Jesus with this fantastically expensive oil and a huge quantity of it. And the disciples grumble about this and say, you know, we should have sold that and given the money to the poor. And Jesus says, the poor you will always have with you, but you will not always have me. Now, Theo Harris hears that sort of thrown back at her frequently in the course of her own work to end poverty, thrown back at her from Christians who say, well, Jesus said poverty's always going to be there. There's no way that we can end it. Or even, it's not God's intention that we end it. And so this kind of rode like a burr under her saddle for a while. And this book is sort of the outgrowth of that verse being thrown back at her. So we're going to look at what Jesus was really saying there when he said, "The poor will always be with you." And we're going to look at how Jesus and the wider biblical witness talk about poverty and call us to respond to poverty. So I'm going to give you the chapter titles. We're going to do these, again, one chapter a week as we move through the book. The first chapter, this will be next week, is Ending Poverty Possible? Is Ending Poverty Possible? The second chapter will be Reading the Bible with the Poor. Reading the Bible with the Poor. The third chapter, No Needy Among You. No Needy Among You. The fourth chapter, the title in quotation marks, Don't Laugh, Folks, Jesus Was a Poor Man. Chapter 5, More Than Flinging a Coin to a Beggar. And chapter 6 will be Christ, the Social Movement Leader. And then our final week, we will look at the conclusion and ask how we can start ending poverty today. So I'm going to turn to some reflection questions in just a moment to kind of just open up the conversation here. But I want to acknowledge that Covenant has always had a real sense of mission to address poverty and the effects of poverty in the communities around us and the communities around the world. So this is something that should feel really close to home for us. It should feel like something that we kind of either have always known or have always been waiting for someone to say to us. And I think it should also continue to challenge us. It should challenge us, I think, particularly because Theo Harris is talking about how could we end poverty, not how could we sort of ameliorate the effects of poverty, right? But how could we address the causes of poverty? How can we get down to the root of where poverty comes from? And so it should also challenge us and challenge the ways that we think about the mission work that we undertake, which much of which is focused on addressing and working to deal with poverty in our world. So I want to acknowledge that this should be things that we're already working on and thinking about. This should also, I hope, challenge us in a productive way. So look at me. I just partly answered the first question, because I'm good like that. So I want to ask, how would you describe our congregation's relationship to poverty? And what have we done to address the effects of poverty? What have we done to address the causes of poverty? So three layers of the question there. What's our relationship with poverty? What have we done to address its effects? And what have we done to address its causes?
I think we've had a relatively close relationship with it.
Yeah, how so?
Well, as far as a helping the poor and organizations that help the poor around the city, mm-hmm. and over in El Salvador.
Good. And what have we done as a congregation to address the effects of poverty? What are some of the ways that we do that?
Meals from the Heartland.
Would you just go on to
your panel? Meals from the Heartland. So, and Meals from the Heartland is packaging food that can be distributed to folks who are in poverty, who don't have enough good food to eat. And so they can just right there for free cook a meal for six people out of one bag, yeah.
The Faith and Grace Garden.
The Faith and Grace Garden. So a place where food is grown and distributed to food pantries and fresh produce, which is really expensive to buy. but is also a really important dietary thing. Yeah.
Annual support to Cross Ministries.
Annual support to Cross Ministries, which works to address homelessness and ideally prevent homelessness. Yeah. Kayla?
Hunger Hike, DMARC Pantry.
Hunger Hike, DMARC. Yeah. So ways of getting food out to folks who can't afford the food. Yeah.
I think a little closer to home, too, is the assistance we attempt to give to Head Start.
Yeah.
Because we've had clothing drives mm-hmm. for that, and then also just some other volunteer kinds of
yeah.
things that go with that.
Yeah, so we work alongside Head Start with clothing drives and efforts like that to support those families as well, yeah.
The Diaper Ministry.
Coming up this Tuesday evening and Wednesday morning, right here in this room, when we sew diapers to send primarily to Haiti is where they go. And so folks there have the ability to have reusable diapers rather than having to buy disposable diapers, which if you haven't done that lately, they are also phenomenally expensive. Great. So what have we done to address the causes of poverty? And we'll talk more in coming weeks about what those causes of poverty are, but you'll probably have some sense of things we might have done in order to address the causes of poverty.
Well, as a former educator, I'm awful biased, but I think West Des Moines and maybe even all of Iowa understand the connection between education and poverty.
Uh-huh.
And when it comes to passing increases in property taxes for school needs, I'm not saying that they 100% of them pass, mm-hmm. but I think Iowa, and specifically the length of time I've been in West Des Moines, and there again, I'm biased, but lack of job skills. See, jobs cure a lot of problems. And people that just don't have any skills that are needed, they're trapped.
Right. So what have we done as a congregation toward job skills, toward funding for schools, that sort of thing?
Well, as long as you've got me on the stump here, I think there's some service organizations of which I'm a member of, Kiwanis. We've kind of adopted an elementary school, and guys go over and help or assist kids read once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And the alternate high school where Deb Kellogg's husband works on 8th Street, we've been over there supporting, I don't want to call it a pantry, but not only food, but also maybe soap and toothpaste and things that high school age kids are needing.
Yeah,
so I'm not saying that that's a direct connection from Covenant, but as a Covenant member,
yeah.
I'm sure there's a lot of us in service organizations that do similar projects.
Great, thank you. Yeah.
We support Dorothy's House, which is a home for the girls that have been trafficked.
Yes.
And are trying to get back into a normalcy.
Right, so supporting Dorothy's House sort of has, it's got two different sides, right? So there's the immediate addressing the effects of girls having been trafficked, but then Dorothy's House has a really holistic approach to we want to get skills, we want to get education, we want to get girls back on their feet in an independent way. Yeah, good. Okay, I'm going to ask a slightly harder question. So we were talking about our congregation's relationship to poverty. What can you tell me about our congregation's relationship to poor people? What's our relationship to people who are poor? And how is that similar or different from our relationship to poverty as a condition?
Well, your relationship to a poor person is going to be one to one.
Mm-hmm.
And your relationship to poverty is going to be very not near as personal.
Uh-huh.
And I'm trying to think of the word I want to use, and I can't think of it.
Arm's length relationship?
Yes, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Yeah, so a relationship with a poor person is going to be much more face-to-face.
Yes.
And a relationship to poverty is going to be a little bit more sort of out there just because of the scale of the thing, right? Poverty is a big thing. A person is a person, yeah.
I think kind of elaborating on what you're saying, only with the other side of the coin, is that we have a tendency, I'll make that more personal, I have a tendency to be able to contribute to Dorothy's house or something where we set up a drive or we're in an organization that does something because that's well within my comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
Getting on a one-to-one basis with somebody who is standing on the corner with a sign,
mm-hmm,
takes me totally out of my comfort zone.
Uh-huh.
And so I think, as far as I'm concerned, the relationship with a person, a poor person, or a person that I perceive as being a poor person, is would take a major effort on, uh-huh, my part. And I don't think that as a church, and I hesitate to speak for everybody, but I don't see us really getting that involved.
Uh-huh.
And I know there's, you know, when you go down to Meals for the Heartland, are you just working with other churches?
Right.
Versus where you're one-to-one if you go down to the mission itself and serve the meals.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. And I appreciate that honesty. I think that's that is definitely consistent with my experience of churches in general and this church in particular, that that going into someone else's element and getting to know them on a one-to-one way is a much harder thing. Yeah.
I think the exception would be San Isidro, though.
Yeah. So what's different about San Isidro?
Not the whole church, so.
It's not the whole church, because not everyone can travel to San Isidro, and not everyone is moved to.
But once again, you're in the same situation. I'm happy to hand you a $50 check to cover their water, whatever we did in Bible school this year.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not so hot to go to San Isidro.
Yeah.
Right.
And yeah, and that's what I'm putting, or that, what we last year had that video from, I can't remember what organization.
Oh, from JAPA that goes,
yes,
out to the,
yes,
to the places where,
right,
homeless folks
so
are living.
So their question is, you know, if you would like to volunteer, we'd be glad to have you. And if you'd like to give us a contribution, and so here's my check.
Right.
I guess that's
right.
You're
saying,
where I come from.
Yeah, you're saying, thanks for the invitation to volunteer, here's a check.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But we need both sides.
We do, absolutely need both sides, yeah.
And
but they are two different things.
Getting,
yeah,
to what you read, we do. We talk about it on Sunday, and then miss that person on Monday.
Right. Yeah. So we talk.
There's the discretionary fund that you have, that you,
yes,
have people that you've spoken about, that, mm-hmm, you do on our behalf, although it's not us directly.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and so I actually really treasure the relationships that I get to have, which are often very, very brief, right? Mm-hmm. But the relationships that I get to have through that discretionary fund, which I feel a little bit bad for you that you don't get to have those relationships. Now, I know you're not all feeling like, please let me have one of those relationships. But there is something to that, being sort of being face to face with someone and understanding what they're going through. Yeah.
Can you repeat your question?
Yeah. So the the question was, how would you describe our congregation's relationship to people who are poor? How is this relationship similar to or different from our relationship to poverty? So I think Betty and Jean really got the idea there, that this is, it's a difference between sort of, are we working a little bit at a distance, or are we working directly up close with someone?
Well, just as a follow-up, somebody said that we need both. And I can assure you, it took me a long time to understand the value of spending money on plane tickets to go to San Ysidro, as opposed to just sending the money down to the mission coworker and they buy seed and fertilizer. But after I experienced my first trip, and I'm not saying that the residents of San Ysidro don't appreciate the groceries and the fertilizer and the corn, but I just can't get over, and I can't express, those that are in there can maybe help me out here, they want to see these people from West Des Moines Covenant, and for us to be in their home, and 50, what'd we do it in about less than 3 days, 52 homes in about 3 days, but they, I think they look at us as a sign of hope, and we paired up, and like I say, I'm the same way, Gene. I'm going to write the check, you know, as opposed to going down and intermingling, but it really came home to me in the Senate. I've been there three times. They want, when are you coming back?
Yeah.
It's not, when will I get more seed, or when will I get more groceries, or even student scholarship? They appreciate and mention that every time, but I'm always so impressed with the value they put on West Des Moines Presbyterians coming to their home, and they feed us, enjoy feeding us at noon, and it took me a while to get that appreciation, and so we need both. We need the money.
So by the same token, then, what you're saying, I'm just saying then maybe the relationship should be even more close to home. So consequently, how do we know that what you're describing on how thrilled they are, best for the lack of a better word, to have you interact and become a personal relationship with the people in San Ysidro might also be if you were working with Joppa, and or if you were working with any of the other things, maybe there would be the same within our own community.
Right.
I think there's a huge benefit to the personal relationship piece, because I've done things I would never have done because of my passion for San Ysidro.
Yeah.
Like, I don't like to ask for money, but I stood up in front of the church and asked for money for water tanks, right?
Yeah.
And so you do that because of your passion, because of your relationship with them.
Yeah.
So while I'm with Gene here in Des Moines, that I would probably rather give money or package meals where I don't actually meet anyone. Mm-hmm. I can see the benefit of the relationship because it does drive you with the passion.
Yeah.
On that topic.
So let's look close to home here. Theo Harris gave us this scene from Kensington, Philadelphia, 20 years ago. And Kensington's not a whole lot better these days. But she described this process of deindustrialization. It was an industrial part of town. That's where people's work was, that's where people's money came from, and then the factories increasingly automated, and some of the factories just moved their operations to somewhere with lower labor costs, and 250,000 jobs left. Now, you need a whole lot of jobs to begin with to be able to lose 250,000 of them, right? But that's what deindustrialization was for Kensington. Where have you seen a comparable process of deindustrialization in the urban, suburban, and rural communities near us?
Well, in Newton, didn't they lose their factory?
Maytag.
When Newton lost the Maytag factory.
And there were a lot of people put out of work.
Right.
I'm not sure what the next step was for them, but that was the first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when a big pillar employer like a Maytag moves out of town or consolidates and reorganizes, and whatever exactly happened, I don't recall all the details, but when you lose a pillar employer like that, where else have we seen it?
Pioneer went through that same thing.
Pioneer has gone through the same thing.
Well, I personally worked for Guide One Insurance, and the life in insurance company was sold off to Kansas City Life, and so there were about 45 of us employees that were slated to lose our jobs, and I stayed to the end, and yes, I lost my job, and
yeah.
At age 60, I had to go out and find a job, which is hard at that age.
Yeah, that's a real tough age to get new work, isn't it?
Yeah, it took me quite a few months.
So even in a white-collar setting, you've got the same sort of, because corporate restructuring happens in that way and consolidates, shifts jobs elsewhere, even in that setting, you've got really comparable deindustrialization.
Well, not necessarily. You think of industrialization, you're thinking more manufacturing, I think. But what about Yonkers?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And three-fourths of Valley West Mall that is open because of the changing way of shopping or...
Right.
Or,
talk about like Yonkers Sears. I mean, Sears, uh-huh. Sears is going out.
Right. So comparable to the sort of disappearance of industry is the disappearance of brick-and-mortar retail, right? Mm-hmm. So I said, hey, here's a book that you might be interested in reading. And what was our first question?
Amazon,
right? So, and there are buildings with books in them that will sell those books to you, right? But we don't even go there. Yeah. There's a really big one that's kind of close to my heart and close to a lot of our hearts. Who grew up on a farm? Is that farm still a farm anymore?
Yes.
Yeah? Yeah? No?
Housing.
How many people did it take to work the farm when you grew up, Alice?
It was my parents, my sister, and I.
And you were probably all working full-time at that, right?
Mm-hmm.
How many people does it take to work the same number of acres today?
They have all this huge equipment that costs
a fortune.
Yes, a fortune, and most of them can't pay it off.
Mm-hmm.
And then one person.
Right. One person driving 32 rows of equipment, right? As opposed mm-hmm. to one person with four or eight or whatever rows, depending on what stage in the... This is actually... It's a kind of... it's almost industrialization, right? Except that agriculture has been industrial since at least the plow. It is the automation, even of farming, has led to a real loss of jobs. Now, you know, we don't count the jobs in quite the same way when we count them on farms, because we've got kids working, we've got incidental work, and the money comes in differently. But there's still jobs, right? And there's still jobs that have now been lost because of the transformation of how that particular industry works. So these are all places where we could recognize even right here among us that shift from one way of being employed to a whole different model for how income works in people's lives. So I wanna invite you, as we sort of wrap up today, I wanna invite you to see if you can remember or recognize in the world around us moments when people have come together to create community. And particularly comparable to the story that's told here of homeless families moving into a church, and you know, it wasn't a long-lived community. That community is no longer present in that form, but it did have lasting effects in Kensington. And be attentive, either in your recollection seeing this happen before, or in the news, or in the community around you. Where do you see poor people coming together and creating community?
because we're gonna be turning more and more to that, to identify the agency of people who are poor in creating community that way. So that's our first class session. If you want help getting your hands on a book, please let me know. We will turn to chapter 1, Is Ending Poverty Possible? We'll look at that next week. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.